Welcome to the Jess Larson Show on Innovation and Leadership. On this episode, we've got repeat guest Richard Wilson back on the show. Richard, thanks for doing this.
Thanks for having me here, Jess. Appreciate it.
You have a long resume to potentially get introduced between all the books and all the businesses and the fun projects. Why don't you give people some of the highlights?
Yeah, I'll give you the short version. If you think they care about anything else, happy to go deeper. So 16 years ago, I started an investor club called Family Office Club. Since then, we've hosted 195 live events. I've written 13 books. We run media platforms, like we own billionaires.com, where we're interviewing 100 billionaires. We've done 25 so far, like Tony Robbins, Mark Cuban, Grant Cardone, Jeff Hoffman, et cetera. In addition to that, we've helped set up about 200 family offices for ultra wealthy families. And we do 15 live events a year. So I don't know if there's anything else super relevant. I'm married with three girls at home and my wife. And I guess the last thing is just that we focus our energy for our balance sheet, even though our investor club looks at 1,000 different things, really on the short-term rental space and then on medical practices that are profitable.
That's great. Well, I'd love to talk about both those things. Why don't we start there? Our listeners know that we're pursuing stuff in the short-term rental Airbnb world. I'm interested, what attracts you to that space?
One of the top things is that when we host our investor club events, we have a lot of multifamily and storage people there. And it was important to me that people don't see it as highly competitive with a whole bunch of people in my investor club. And I just want to do something that's unique. There's not many people like yourself that I can trade notes with in the industry on like a professional private equity type approach to STRs. And so we like co-investing with people like yourself, trading ideas, you know, niches, where you focused and why, and et cetera. We also like that less than 1% of the short-term rental space is owned by institutions, where 25% of multifamily is, 17% of storage is. Eventually, if you build up 100, 300, 500 STR assets, there's going to be institutions wanting to pick up a bundle of those in a big package. So that's a big motivation for us as well.
I totally agree with everything you said. It's interesting to me why it's taking so long. If you watch the news closely, you see like the little toe in the water that a few of them are doing. In your mind, what do you think is taking a while for them to catch on to such strong margins?
Yeah, I think one part of it is that when you look at single family residential communities like SFR, they like to buy whole neighborhoods at once. And once you get a lease in place and you get a property manager, you know, it's pretty consistent income and it's annual. And so it's lower turnover, lower hassle. And so the fact that property managers, there's not very many of them who've done a really great job at STR property management. And then not many private equity firms could say, here's a $40 million package of STRs. Here's a $200 million package. While the home builders can crank out a neighborhood and sell a whole neighborhood to Goldman Sachs. I think that's part of it. It's a little bit easier to find long-term renters and that's more stable operationally. So that's my number one best guess. It's also a much newer industry, right? SFR has been around for 100 plus years and, you know, STR has really been more professionalized the last, you know, obviously 25 years as Airbnb kind of, you know, became known to everybody a good 15 years ago or so. Everyone was recognized the name, et cetera. So I feel like it's just lagging these other areas a bit. SFR is only 2.4% owned by institutions. And you see headlines every month about Goldman Sachs or some big insurance group buying a whole neighborhood, right? And it's only 2.4% by institutions. So that shows how massive the space is, right?
Yeah, no kidding. You know, one advantage I see in STR too is from getting interest for people to hear about a deal in the first place. I think it was one of yours, and correct me if this wasn't one of yours. I watch a lot of your videos online. I've been following you for years. I think it was you, but maybe it wasn't, talking about why like luxury condos gets talked about like its own asset class, even though on a dollar perspective, it shouldn't be. It's just so many of the investors are interested in one that they talk about it, where so often, you know, investors aren't as excited to talk about HUD investments because they would never want to live in one themselves, and it's harder to be objective. To me, it seems like an advantage where some STRs are very exciting. I mean, we've all seen like gorgeous looking Airbnbs and even the investors would want to use it themselves, seems like it could be helpful.
Yeah, for sure. There is an allure of that, you know, in some investment programs, you know, allow you to use the assets or use them at a discount. And there's some advantages that way, just practically. Obviously, making it a really good investment return for the investor is what's most important. And then the other issue that leads to a better investment return, I think, is the scalability of it for a group like yourself or myself, right? So right now, we're picking up and building pods of assets in Hawaii and Florida. And we have assets in, you know, 5 other states already. But a lot of times institutions look at an apartment building, they're like, wow, we make one purchase and we get 500 units or 300 units. And then if they can't buy a package of STRs from someone, then getting a geographical hub put together is another way to scale. And so that's something that, you know, I'd love to trade notes with you on over time. And just because of the less seasonality, not being like in Park City or in some parts of Colorado, the beach locations is for now where we're building up our hubs of assets as our next path forward.
Well, I'd love to talk about that because we've gotten close on 2 Hawaii deals. We actually had, we had one under contract, $3 million beachfront that had R5 zoning. And we got close on another one that was kind of like Ocean View, 16 acres. And we have struggled with just stability, like regulation stability, as they keep changing the short-term rental rules. And we're like, so we're a cash flow based, you know, we're a cash flow fund focused on quarterly returns. And so that regulatory has, you know, we ended up not letting our money go hard, and we've decided to keep watching right now. How have you thought through that process?
My head property manager used to live in Hawaii and has some great connections there. And so we have a slight advantage there, but also we're very aware of how painful the regulations are there. What we're waiting for right now is a bit of a perfect storm. We're going there in 3.5 weeks to look at some more properties, but looking for that perfect storm of the economy crumbling harder, plus all this regulatory burden that comes with, you know, like no new permits being issued and these very small resort zones, and you're almost forced into buying condos in some places in Hawaii if you want to do STRs. And we're kind of anti-condo, anti-HOA with our fund because we don't like that variable. And so we're waiting for those things to kind of interconnect and just getting buttoned up with the brokers and locations and where we would like to go at what price, et cetera. But Hawaii is super tough to get into. And for that reason, I think a lot of people just give up trying after a little while. And so we're determined to figure it out and to get in there because of the year-round tourism that's going on there, you know?
Well, it's fascinating. So one of our investors has a main home and 3 tiny homes that is just, I mean, tens of thousands a month. I mean, just really doing well that they did personally. And one of our partners, you know, bought into one of those Blackstone owned hotels on the beach that is also, you know, condo/hotel. So they were able to get around the short-term rental rule. And they bought a individual studio unit and then installed bunk beds in the living room and changed it from Sleeps 2 to Sleep 6, you know? and you know, their rates almost tripled, right? And so like there's people who are making it work, you know, and we're fascinated with it, but we're just, you know, we're trying not to gamble.
Yeah, there's a regulatory concern, there's a pricing and where we are in the market concern, the level of debt that you can get on properties, and you have to make the numbers work all cash or seller financing a lot of the time right now. All of our properties so far are no bank debt. We either do seller financing or all cash. So we're very low risk in our approach right now. But I agree with everything you said. Very, very interesting, challenging, but I think that it'll be good barriers to entry. We can figure out a strategy or two that will work there, and we'll be able to figure it out in some other markets. So I just think that wherever you live in the United States, most likely you would enjoy going to Florida or Hawaii sometime, you know, during the year, you know?
Yeah, no kidding. And you're still in Florida, right?
I was for 5 years on the island of Key Biscayne, but now I'm in Scottsdale.
Oh, okay.
But I've still got some team. Some of my team members are in Florida still.
So just out of personal interest, we just got offered a JV opportunity on the south end of the Grand Canyon. And interested in your feelings about Arizona as a, you know, regulatory environment for short-term rental.
Yeah, I mean, the state has a state mandated, you know, you cannot make it illegal to have an STR kind of mandate across the state. So like Sedona, the city of Sedona does not like STRs, but the state will not allow them to make it illegal. They said, well, now it's people's property. If they want to rent it out short-term, they can. And so statewide is very positive right now. You know, could that change at some time? I'm sure it could, but hopefully it will not. We've got several properties here in Scottsdale, up by the Grand Canyon, the Grand Canyon Junction area, as well as Sedona. We've looked at some projects in other locations and just turned them down because of remoteness and just looked like the demand was maybe a little bit soft, but we like it.
Yeah. I'm interested. So we looked at Sedona and a property just right south of the ski resort north of there. And I'm interested in your decision tree. You know, you see so many deals from your events and, you know, What a wisdom opportunity for you to facilitate so many good things happening for your own decision making. But I'm interested, like a Sedona, what your decision tree looks like when you're saying,
yeah,
hey, look at such high desirability, but also maybe some premium pricing and how you think about navigating that.
Yeah, I would say the number one insight I could share that's at the crux of what you're asking about is what we find is that multiple units on one purchase makes the ROI much higher. So like we bought an oceanfront property in Florida that has four units. We have a property in Sedona, one purchase, but we have three structures on it. And we have two different rental properties on it. The Grand Canyon, one purchase, two properties. So we find that makes the math much better. So we're looking for opportunities where we can do something like that. And we also increase the number of people that can sleep at each unit just to stand out in the marketplace. So we can sleep, you know, around 30 people at our Sedona property. And we can sleep 32 people at our Florida property, but that's four units to get to 32. You know, and so we can host a wedding reception party or a, you know, a family reunion type event at some of those properties, you know?
Oh, that's exciting. We've just, been able to get five lots at a Lakeview property where we bought the whole cul-de-sac, and, we're going to be linking all the backyards so that you could rent any number of the five homes for your family reunion, for your event, and kids can run backyard to backyard. And
nice.
You can have like a party in the cul-de-sac and there's no neighbors kind of a thing.
Right,
you
know? Right. That's awesome.
It's got access to a private beach and stuff. So we're hoping that's going to be a good one. But I could talk about this the whole hour, but I want to talk about a few different things. So maybe we'll come back to short-term rental. We are not doing anything in medical, but I look at just the immense dollars being spent by the aging baby boomers. And it just seems like such a rising tide. What are you guys finding attractive as you look at medical real estate?
Yeah, what we're seeing is that, and we're actually not investing in the real estate, we're investing in the operating businesses of the medical practices. Some of those medical practices, they love owning the real estate. And as a byproduct, we may have some real estate holdings by investing in the medical practices. But we are focused on the operating business side of it. And there's two main things we love about it. One is that when somebody goes to school for a decade to become a doctor and they do a residency, then they work usually at some other medical practice and then eventually start their own and then add a second or third or fourth, fifth location. We talk to them between locations two and six usually, and we help them delay the sale to private equity until they get to 10, 12 or 20 plus locations. What we like about it is by the time we talk to them, they've spent 17 years of their life's work on this career. They're very unlikely just to disappear and run away to Venezuela or Bali and never see them again, right? So they're very committed, dedicated people, reliable people usually. And when you combine that with the fact that when you get to 10, 12 plus locations in a medical practice platform, you can often sell for 10 times, 12 times EBITDA, sometimes even more. And so you have reliable, dedicated partners, but you can sell at a high multiple. Just kind of allows us to sleep at night. We're pretty conservative. We're low debt, like I talked about before, low leverage. We just like to work with really great people, with great business models, great partners. And so by focusing on that niche, we've been able to pick up equity stakes in about 24 medical practices, be 25 here soon, with $50 million a year in revenue across these different investments. And we're looking to double that over the next 1 or 2 years because we're not coming in and taking over. We are just helping them with growth capital and delaying their sale to private equity. And then in the dermatology space, we are looking to build out a platform of our own over time. And we are looking for a couple of acquisitions that we could make kind of outright in the dermatology space, or more 50-50 type joint venture in that space.
I'm interested when you think about that. So maybe to begin with, what is like a, what's an ideal multiple that you're looking to acquire at?
Lots of times when somebody has 2, 3, 4 locations, or if they have one location, might be 3 to 5 times EBITDA. If they have 2 to 4 locations, might be 4 to 6 times EBITDA, even 4 to 7 times EBITDA, or 7 and change. But what matters a lot more than the multiple are the terms, right? Like, so somebody could acquire you at 8 times EBITDA, but maybe the terms are not very good for you because they get to pay you out over 15 years or something crazy, right? Or sometimes people say, oh, I got a 7.6x, but really half of it was cash and half was equity in this big company that may sell in a decade to private equity or may not. So you really got 3.7x. Now you have to wait a decade and cross your fingers. So that matters a whole lot more than the multiple, but just general ballpark, those are the multiples that we see. And so
for a cash offer,
for a cash offer, you know, usually the 3 to 5 for a low chain and 4 to 7 for a medium size, and then 7 to 10 for, you know, 7 to 10 locations.
And are you buying control? Are you buying outright? Are you buying a minority?
So in the dermatology space, we're looking to buy control mostly, although we would consider minority. We're open to control in the dermatology sector, but in with other medical practices to date, we've just been doing minority growth capital. And we're basically, we come in as a, almost like an advisory board member, as their head of investor relations. And these doctors are usually not, the founders are not great at raising capital or structuring deals. So we have a proprietary structure that allows us to bring in capital, mostly from other doctors and family offices, capitalize their platform, grow it. And we structure it so that the owner of that medical practice platform doesn't lose much equity at all, but the investor gets a good return and gets to double their money over time in the deal. And so by balancing that, where the investor's happy, but the CEO didn't get diluted a whole bunch, and makes it so everybody across the board is happy with the relationship.
You know, a structure that you definitely see in the energy space that I haven't seen a lot of elsewhere, I've heard you talking about, for people who maybe are just used to plain vanilla venture capital terms or PE firms terms or, you know, traditional M&A, can you talk about the idea of gross overriding royalties or?
Sure. Yeah, that, yeah, I love model. Talking about structure. I think structure is not focused on by enough investors. And with gross revenue royalties, we've done 13 of these deals. We're about to do a couple more. And essentially what we do is we make it so that you as an investor get your money back off the top line revenue. And some people hear this and say, why would a CEO ever agree to that? But there's multiple reasons. So as an investor, if they grow faster, you get paid back faster. They grow a little bit slower or go down a little bit, then you get paid back a little bit slower. But it doesn't matter if they're profitable or not. You get your payment out every month and you get cash flow every month, which is great. With a lot of companies, you invest in a small to medium-sized company, they're growing, and they never kick out distributions. And you're just crossing your fingers for 7 or 10 or 12 years, and you may only get an update once a year, and you don't get anything but a K-1 maybe. And so for the company CEO, if it can be structured so the investor gets cash flow, they get taken care of, they get a return threshold, or they get treated well, then you don't have to give them as much equity maybe as you would have if you were just giving them straight equity. And so it allows the CEO to grow without selling their whole business. So the average Inc. 500 CEO, they only own 12% of their own business. So they basically sold their soul to get on the Inc. 500 and become a big business. And maybe they were smart to do so because maybe they're worth $100 million now, but you had to sell everything to get there. And so we help medical practice CEOs that have platforms grow without having to give away as much equity. And then that way it's a win-win for both. And there's a dozen ways to structure the gross revenue royalty. So happy to answer any more questions you have on that.
Yeah. Do you want to just give us a couple of examples of how to structure that?
Yeah, sure. So with some deals, we'll structure a royalty so that the investor gets, you know, X percent, like 4% gross revenue royalty paid out every month or every quarter. And they get that until they double their money, or they get that plus some bonus depreciation until they get 1.5 times their money, or they double their money. And then if the company does ever sell to private equity, they get a little kicker that gets them to 2.5X or 3X their money, or they get a 1% right of participation kicker when the company sells. But the main point is to turn it into a cash flowing investment. And we talked to a lot of people who have just recently sold their company, either it went public or they sold their real estate portfolio or they sold their private business. And now they're trying to replace that income. They need passive income to replace that $500,000 a year, $1.5 million a year they used to make. And so they really like the monthly or quarterly income from a company doing 10, 20 million a year in revenue. It's not a startup and it's a stable partner, usually with collateral in place. And they really are attracted to that type of an offering because it just looks different than your average multifamily syndication or the stock market or different things that people normally invest in.
Why do you think so few folks in the private investment world recognize the power of putting together cash flow deals? I mean, like, you can come across the like, eventually we're going to flip this and you'll be rich deals all day long everywhere. But like well-structured cash flow deals you can rely on, investors, in my observation, love them so much. And yet there's so few people, it seems like, putting them together.
Yeah, well, it forces a brutal honesty. Like, you cannot fake distributions unless you're doing something illegal. So there's some forced honesty there on a quarterly or monthly basis. Otherwise, investors expect the distribution and you have to go to them and say, sorry, no, that was our intent, but this quarter did not go well. We had a fire or a flood or bad economy, et cetera. So that's one thing. It's like this forced accountability, real short term. It's easier to be like, hey, we're going to give you nothing for like a little bit less than a decade. And then between inflation and us doing good stuff, you know, something good will happen for you. And look at our track record. We promise it'll be so. But by the way, we're going to charge you fees every year along the way. So a lot of people have that approach, and it's easier to do that because you can compound it and just keep that income internal if there is that income. So that's one reason. But I don't know. I think that there's at many of our conferences, I've said, raise your hand if you've ever done a deal using gross revenue royalties. And one time we had one family from Norway who raised their hand and said they love them, but almost no one else ever uses them in the family office space. I don't know why. It's strange.
It's so common in junior oil and gas, at least in Western Canada. And it's because everybody knows about shenanigans in the oil and gas business. And when you take a GOR, they call it gross overriding royalty, right? When you take a GOR, you know, it's the truth. Like, there's no stories. Either you got the check or you didn't, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's right. And so I think it's going to be more and more popular in the future. We've been talking about it for a while, and still I don't see too many people doing it, which is fine. It just makes our life a bit easier. But I think for anyone listening here, if you're running a platform, you know, focusing on just one or two niches and getting really good in there, and then as an investor, you know, to identify things that are unique from other things your money are in, so you're not investing in, you know, nine different multifamily syndications all within the same states of Florida and Texas or something, you know.
Yeah. You know, another thing that I admire about the way you conduct your business and improve yourself, you know, I've done almost 900 episodes of the show now, 800 and something, right? And it's like my favorite thing. Like, I get to meet all these great people. I get mentoring, coaching, connections, right? But you've taken that to another level. I want to talk about your, like, I heard you say, you know, I felt like I didn't have as much background on tax. So I decided to do a whole series. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So basically, I realized how important it was to be dialed in on my own tax planning and help my clients. And so we went out and did a 50 expert audio series with tax experts. And we hosted a couple tax strategy summits. And we did these 10-minute interviews with like Tom Wheelwright and an expert on historic tax credits and an expert on being designated as a real estate professional in the eyes of the IRS, et cetera. And then basically I tell people like, hey, obviously you're not getting comprehensive or customized advice in a 10-minute interview, but now you know an expert in the tax code for solar tax or credits or whatever it may be. And that's half the battle, is just knowing that the strategy exists on planet Earth. And here's one person at least who knows something about that topic. And you can kind of tuck that away in your mind and be like, oh, okay, R&D tax credits. So I'm doing software programming or manufacturing in the United States. That could be like a huge tax credit for many businesses. I have no idea that it exists. And so we just try to, just like you, I guess, leverage our platform in a way that helps our community, but then selfishly helps ourselves as well. So when we look at Family Office Club, which is the name of our investor club, we see it as a perpetual learning machine for myself, my team, and for our members, so that whenever we host an event, hopefully we are making money, of course, but also coming away with like new structures, new strategies, new niches to consider, different ways people are, you know, giving talks or generating relationships, et cetera. And it's just kind of like, there's all these byproducts that come from doing a podcast or hosting all these live events, which is what really keeps it interesting.
Yeah. You know, it's so easily overlooked, right? We ended up having to switch CPAs because we, you know, being in the short-term rental business, we were connecting with somebody who theirs was awesome at cost segregation for STR. And we're like, wow, I don't think ours has thought for 2 minutes about that, let alone specialized in it.
Right.
You know, and we ended up switching because of it.
Yeah. I'm few interested. People specialize in
finish your thought there. I'm interested in, you know, 50 of those later, you know, insights or things that you didn't expect or thoughts.
Yeah. One biggest insight is that every deal you do could either be optimized for taxes for yourself or for your investors, depending on what side you're on, or both. And every investment that an investor makes could either come from a tax efficient account structure, or they could be using a tax strategy for that allocation. Whether they're investing through their kids, or whether they are loaning money to someone else who's actually technically making the investment, or it's coming from a self-directed IRA or something of that nature. And so that's one of the number one things. And then the other thing is to think about structuring different classes within an LLC. And one class might be equity. Another class, maybe you're going to have them be equity, but really, if they're an income investor, maybe they're just okay with a preferred return of X amount, and they get kicked out income either as a debt instrument with collateral, so they still feel safe and maybe equity felt more safe to them, or some other way. But by having less people in the equity stack, any depreciation might flow to them in a concentrated manner, which would allow them to have more of a write-off perhaps if that's alluring to them. So you always want to be careful though. Investments that you do should be like a great investment that then is, you know, slightly optimized for taxes versus an investment that's just done so that people don't have to pay taxes. You know, you don't want the marketing of it or the truth of it to be like, oh, just do this because it's good for your taxes, right? It has to be like a good investment. You know, otherwise you're going to find yourself, you know, in tax court one day answering tough questions, or could get in trouble for this or that. So it's just not worth being that extreme on your tax planning that you're, you know, just marketing a tax dodge, basically. You want to stay far away from that.
I know we're jumping around to a lot of topics. Like, usually I like to have a more cohesive conversation. You just have so many interesting things that I want to, you know, I've had a few billionaires on this show, but not nearly as many as you've interviewed. Did you say you've interviewed like 40 so far for your series?
I've done about 25 billionaire interviews so far.
What have been some of the insights of, you know, concentrating, of having those, you know, as part of a series that have come to you?
Yeah, one insight is just the basic premise that, like, when I'm at one of our conferences, I'll have, you know, 500 people raise their hand. I'll say, who has read more than like 5 books written by a billionaire? And sometimes one hand will go up, sometimes 3 hands. Maybe they've forgotten they read a Richard Branson book or something. So it's given the benefit of the doubt. Maybe the average business person's read 3, 5, or 7 books. It's almost never more than 1 or 2 people in a room of hundreds of people. But everyone in that room has read 50 plus or 100 plus business books. But we're reading books that are good from authors who are good at marketing their books, not people who are really good at business to the point where they become a billionaire, which is kind of weird, right? Like, why would you study basketball from some kid at Duke when you could be learning how to shoot free throws from like Michael Jordan or LeBron or something that Kobe recorded before he passed away, et cetera? Like, it makes no sense. You'd first want to seek out coaching and help from NBA players, not college level players. And most best-selling authors are college level players compared to billionaires. And so I've identified 240 books written by billionaires, and I've read about 50 of those now. And I'm reading one by Henry Ford right now. And I'm going through them all. And I think it'll be really interesting to read all 240 books, because that'll help me get more of these interviews done. But also, I'm sure other good things will come from it. But it's interesting to think, like, how come we're not reading 90% of the books are from billionaires? Like, why is it the opposite? That we read almost nothing from the most successful people. But like, oh yeah, you got to read this book. It's so good about this, this, and that. But like, you know, the guy's not a billionaire, so why start there, right? So that's like the most interesting thing that's come of it. Because once you say it out loud, you're like, oh yeah, that makes like a ton of sense. And then the other funny thing is, like, people say like, oh wow, you're studying all these billionaires. Like, Richard, maybe you'll become a billionaire after interviewing all these billionaires, like, hey, I mean, like, it's not my mission on planet Earth. Something great happens to my wealth. Of course, that's a positive thing for my family. But it is so obviously, like, when you hang out with a certain number of people in a space, then people associate you with them, even if you're nowhere near being a billionaire, because naturally, you know that if you read all that stuff and you watched all the interviews and watched all the YouTube videos, that your brain would expand in that direction. It's like a natural human intuition to think that way. So that's been interesting, just to see people's reactions and people's actions of not really studying billionaires very much.
Yeah, and that's at billionaires.com?
Yeah, you can see the interviews at billionaires.com. The two best ones, just to start out with some powerful ones, are Tony Robbins. He answered our questions in audio format, and he had amazing answers. And then Jeff Hoffman gave a one-hour talk at our annual event not too long ago, and we recorded that, and his talk had like half the room in tears, and it was like 52-year-old male investment professionals on average, which don't usually cry at investment conferences, right? So if you check those two out, it'd be a really good first step to seeing what we're about at billionaires.com and kind of sharing these ideas.
Have you published your book list, your 250 books you're reading?
I haven't published it yet, but I do have it in Excel. I can send it to you. And then
I love that.
We want to put it on billionaires.com and then rank them with like our favorite books at the top. So if you want to read a bunch, you start with the good ones at least. Because some of them, like the Henry Ford one's pretty dry, honestly. I've got like 20% of it left. But like he goes in such detail about how they self-manufacture their glass and turn this like wheat into a rubber-like substance and the technical process. And it's like, oh my God. You know, it gets like way too technical in some parts. So like not all of them are amazing, obviously, right?
You know, an old one that not many people know. Do you know Conrad Hilton wrote a book? Like the original Hilton from Hilton Hotels?
I don't know if I have that on my list or not. I'll have to look and see. What's it called?
Oh.
No?
It's been a couple of years, but it's okay. One I hadn't heard of. And
sure.
And it was just like, You get like the full Wild West story of like, anyways, I thought it was
That's
great.
Awesome.
So
I'll look that up.
I'm interested with events. You know, you're 195 plus events. What are some of the biggest lessons you've learned from all the years of doing these with such high profile people?
Yeah, I think one thing is to realize that the quality matters more than the quantity of people in the room. So you could try to host a 1,000-person event, and that sounds so impressive. You had 1,000 people there, but if they all paid $100 to get in, or you lost money while hosting it, then who cares? It's not sustainable. It's not going to be high quality. The trick is to find some critical mass and size while having the quality be high, and then always having the quality go higher and higher over time. We've found, you know, in business, you always want to do a higher revenue number, more participants, more, but we've found that with events, there's a dynamic that changes when you just have a mob of people that are not highly accomplished versus a medium amount of really high quality, because you want to make it enjoyable for you to attend all the events as well. And as you grow, you know, after doing 900 episodes on this podcast, you know, you might want to host a different quality of people after doing 50 or 100 events, et cetera. The other thing is that you just have to be pretty clear with your values at the start of the event, kind of set the tone for the event, and then clear with your team. And then maybe after an event, there might be 300-400 people that came. There might be one or two people that really just don't belong there the next time around. And so just not being shy about that. You might have to refund somebody or find some nice way to let them know, or just when they try to come the next time, tell them no in a nice way. But that's important, just keep the quality of the community high, because otherwise they could turn off 2 or 3 or 4 other people who might be thinking like, oh, I wonder why Richard allows this person to come. This person's like way out there or something, you know? And so you can't help that when you run a big event. It's going to be like the 1 or 2% that get in that maybe are not the best, but to kind of make sure your team knows to kind of be cleansing the crowd all the time to keep it higher and higher quality is important.
Yeah, no kidding. You know, we've covered a bunch of subjects here. What's one that you're passionate about we haven't talked about so far?
I think the topic of being ultra healthy is something that is really important to me. A lot of my clients are ultra wealthy and they're worth 10 million, 50 million, a couple hundred million. But a lot of them are obese, don't exercise enough, don't have like a really dialed in diet. And a lot of them are taking their health a little bit for granted. And what's weird is that even if you are really focused on business and you think, oh, I'm too busy for health related things, it doesn't matter if you're like the greediest person on planet Earth. The thing is, if you don't live as long or you get hospitalized more easily, you know, when you die, unless you have amazing tax planning, you usually get taxed a lot and it's not a good thing. And no one around you is happy, hopefully. Right. And so if you wait until it becomes a big problem, it's too late. But when you're making more than $300,000 to $400,000 a year, or you're worth more than $3 to $5 million, you have zero excuses not to be moving your body around, going to the grocery store, not looking at prices, just buying the most nutritious food that's best for your body. And a lot of my clients don't do that and they don't get that. But when I bring it up to them, they really appreciate any tools we've identified for getting like a blood sample taken by a nurse at your home to identify different blood markers. And also part of being ultra healthy is going on fun adventures and having good relationships with your kids and spouse, et cetera. So I just got back from Everest Base Camp. We went to Nepal for 2 weeks. Last week I got back, and in 10 days I'm going to Vancouver Island up in Canada to do the West Coast Trail with some of my college buddies. And it's not that hard to be really successful in life if you focus on one thing, niche down, work your butt off for 5, 7, 10 years. You're going to make good money probably, or you chose a bad thing and you should probably switch it to something else that could make more money. It's not that hard to be successful with money, but to be successful and have any type of social life as a male in America who owns a business, usually just taking care of your kids, taking care of family, trying to make it to the gym a couple times a week, have a social life, be emotionally healthy, be doing fun, adventurous, exciting things in life, and just being a good human being and being healthy while making good money. You know, far fewer human beings do all those things versus just make money, right? So you have to think like, what type of an example do you want to be to your family and kids? Do you want to teach them, hey, just work 14 hours a day and just work yourself to death, literally, so you can make all the money and nothing else matters? That's not what people really want to be as an example to other people. And it's not the most enjoyable life. So we're always pointing out to people that, like, at a doctor conference, these people have spent $30,000 a year on their wealth management, and they're doctors, they work in healthcare. One out of 140 of them spent $30,000 on their health the year before. So everyone in the room cared more about their wealth management than their health management. Even though if they're dead, they're just going to get taxed and they can't make any more money, right? So really backwards, and just trying to bring that awareness to the family office space. And then selfishly, just for myself, right? It's like everything I teach or say is also just kind of reminding myself, like, hey, this is important and I need to focus on this too, you know?
I'm happy you're bringing that up. You know, my wife and I had a serious conversation this weekend that I'm working too many Saturdays. And like, right. I've got teenagers. My oldest just did her first year at college this year. And like, what example am I setting, right? And I look at, like, I had the metabolism of a 14-year-old boy until I was about 38, right? Like, I could do, you know, after, like, with dinner, I, you know, 5 cans of A&W root beer, which is my guilty pleasure, and three heaping bowls of mint chip ice cream post-dinner, didn't make a lick of difference, right?
Wow.
And then all of a sudden it flipped, right?
Yeah.
And I saw my brother, who's my business one of my business partners, and we hadn't seen each other for a few months. We were living in different countries at the time. And he like kind of poked me. He's like, oh, chubby bunny, you know, because I gained a little bit, right? And my 16-year-old bet me. We did a $40 no sugar bet. She wanted to do it. She's like, Dad, will you do this with me? Whoever eats sugar this month first owes the other one $40. And I dropped 2 belt sizes in like 3 weeks.
Wow.
And I was like, oh, well, I don't want to just add this back on after, you know? And so I got into the Tim Ferriss 4-hour body thing of kind of, not like a keto or anything, but just like a lower carb lifestyle, maybe more than a diet, you know? And shocking how much less my family eat, how more often my family is to eat eggs for breakfast instead of cereal. And just like, I wasn't trying to push it on anybody in the family, but just because I started eating differently as a lifestyle, like, it's drastically changed what my family eats. And I'm kind of like, I've listened to maybe, if you don't count 300 or 400 Jason Bourne genre books, maybe like, you know, a little over 900 books, business, philosophy, investing. So the most influential one business-wise for me is the billionaire Richard Koch, his book, The 80-20 Principle. And so like I had to have this like real, like I'm sitting here in my office by myself on Saturday thinking like, what would Richard Koch say about this? And he'd say that what I'm using my hours on during the week are the wrong things if I'm needing to work a Saturday. And that by reframing it and saying like, ooh, I need to 80-20 this. I need to get more relentless about how basically almost everything you do makes no difference. And there's a few things that make all the difference. And working hard at the right things instead of working hard, you know? And anyway, so I'm like, I'm a little bit behind you. I'm going through this right now.
Now, I mean, I'm sure there's things that you've learned that I haven't learned yet, right? So one book I read recently by Grant Cardone is called The 10X Mentor. And I'd recommend that book because he talks about scheduling his time in 5-minute segments and just being ruthless about managing his time. And he'll be very enthusiastic and positive, but also ruthless on managing his time. And then the other thing that's really helped me with 3 kids at home is I'll work on Saturdays or Sundays, but not when my kids are conscious. So I'll get up and work from like 5 to 7 a.m. Or like when you go to Hawaii, we were in Hawaii for 9 days earlier this year, and we're going back in 3.5 weeks. When I'm there, I'll get up and I'll work from like, I don't know, 4 a.m. or 5 a.m. until they're having breakfast. And by the time they're done eating breakfast or they start breakfast, then I'm off for the day. And I already worked 3-4 hours. And then it makes it easier to keep up with all my constant travel for fun if I'm getting up and just knocking out some early work. And then they don't miss me and I'm not really neglecting them, as long as I'm getting to bed early enough, it doesn't hurt my health, you know? So that's one thing. But yeah, that's awesome on the whole health change. I mean, having the diet super dialed in, like the exercise part's really easy for me, but the diet part, getting that dialed in where he's eating really nutritious food all the time that's not highly processed and is clean and natural, is something that I'm working on right now. So in the first quarter of this year, I did a body fat reduction contest at my local gym. And then now me and 10 other doctors and friends are doing a muscle gain contest for 90 days, just for fun, to like keep it interesting and kind of tease each other if they didn't gain any muscle over 90 days or whatever, right? So,
well, you know what? My daughter, so she was at home when we did this, right? And now she's graduated and we still talk about food. But it's like, 'cause she had a buddy. Like the buddy system is so underrated. You know, it makes me think like, why do I ever rely on willpower? Like I was a snowboarder in Canada growing up, married a California girl, moved to Huntington Beach so I could surf before work in the morning. There's almost like after my first couple of years, there's almost no winter mornings that I got up and surfed by myself at 5 a.m. And there's almost no winter mornings I ever missed if I was surfing with a buddy, because I wasn't going to be that guy, you know?
Yeah, for sure. I couldn't agree more. I was at a Eben Pagan event like 13 years ago in LA, and I met someone. We were in a mastermind group and all the other mastermind members fell off. And now I've been doing a call with this person for the last 12 years. Every Monday we do an accountability call, and twice a year we'll meet for a full day to do planning now. But we basically say, what's the one thing you're going to get done this week? And it could be business, personal, relationships, food. Usually it's business related, or what's your number one problem or number one opportunity. And we've been doing that every week and it's helped massively. And then the other thing that's been the number one biggest change for me is that it's helped me make the most changes. Is anytime I read an amazing book or get at something I know I need to do, a lot of us know what we need to do, we just don't actually do it. And so every morning I read my monthly goals, quarterly, annual goals on a printed piece of paper that's laminated in my shower where I shave. And then I have all these little like 40 different one-liner statements, like what you do matters more than how hard you work, or I don't go to any meetings I don't want to go to, or I don't work on anything linear, only exponential. Or like Bruce Lee has a quote that's, he says, calm is a superpower. And so I read 40 of these things. I'll send them to you if you want to see what I am brainwashing myself with each morning. And then that way I start out my day knowing what my goals are and my operating system. And then everything else has to bounce off of that during the day. And for me, that really helps me and helps control any ADHD tendencies to chase a new exciting thing or get distracted or get upset about something that doesn't matter, you know?
Yeah. You know, another piece of wisdom I'd love to hear from you is most folks can't seem to connect with ultra high net worth people. And then the ones who do, most of them, it doesn't last. You have been able to connect with, ultra high net worth folks. and then keep relationship with them for years, like many, many years.
Right.
What do you think you're doing differently that other people aren't doing?
I'm long-term focused to a fault sometimes. So I don't try to monetize the relationship right away. I should probably more often. I'd probably be wealthier if I had that a little bit more in balance. But I put a lot of work into writing the books, doing podcasts, doing interviews like this, giving talks at places without charging a speaker fee typically. I'm trying to change that a little bit. And so part of it is that really long-term mindset of just like, I don't need to monetize you right now. Like, here's some value. Let's keep in touch. Maybe I'll introduce you to this person or let me help you structure that. You just give value to them first. And when somebody gets value from you without paying anything, you've de-risked the relationship transaction. And just like them listening to your podcast, then they already like you and they already got some value from you. And it's not like they owe you anything, but it's kind of like if they ever had a chance to help you out or keep you in mind, then they would probably do so, right? So that's just kind of the general mindset, is just kind of a giving mentality of being helpful. I think also growing up, I'm an Eagle Scout, and just growing up in the Boy Scouts and in a household that taught to be respectful and have good manners, as simple as it sounds, if you're just a thoughtful person who actually listens to people, and you're respectful and you just kind of operate by kind of the Boy Scout values, as silly and simple as that sounds, and you actually do what you say you're going to do and add value first, then that really helps. And I just took that and layered that on top of a approach to the family office industry where we put out more content than all of our competitors combined. And so people find us often. And then I guess we just don't repel them at a high rate. And then, you know, we develop relationships with some of them. So pretty simple. But, you know, when Einstein, not that I'm like anywhere near the universe of Einstein level, but like when he was asked like, oh, wow, I can't believe you won the Nobel Prize for discovering relativity. He said, well, I didn't discover it. It was being studied when I was born by scientists much older than me. But I thought only about relativity for 12 years. And because I thought only about relativity, then I was able to solve it. And, you know, my business has been focused on family offices for 16 years. So it's not like I've solved family offices, but, you know, the progress we have is from that focus.
Yeah, it sounds so simple. And yet most of us don't do it, right?
It's kind of like the billionaire idea. I mean, I like ideas that don't cost much, but are inspiring to me and others. Like being ultra healthy is obviously more important than being ultra wealthy, but they don't have to fight each other. You actually become more ultra wealthy if you have high energy and you might attract other people to you. And why would you not study billionaires instead of everyone else on planet Earth first? And you know, those types of ideas, I'm really attracted to those types of ideas. So I started my business with no money, and I had $600 in my bank account. I owed $1,100 a month for my studio apartment in Harvard Square when I launched my business. And so I didn't have money to pay expensive mastermind membership fees or consultants or get debt, or we have no big brother backer in our business. You know, we kind of built it organically from scratch.
Yeah. If people want to find out more, where are the best places online?
I always like by giving away free stuff. You know, we have, if you're on the capital raising side of things, we have a free book for you at capitalraising.com. If you want to come to one of our live events and check out what the charter membership gets you in the Family Office Club, you can see that at familyoffices.com. That's for people raising capital or have a fund or are a service provider to investors. If you're an investor, then just head over to investorclub.com. And then just register there for 30 seconds. And then Laura Clay on my team will probably be reaching out. She's our head of investor relations. And we can kind of welcome you to the community and see how we could be helpful to you.
That's great. Maybe to finish off, what's one of the best pieces of advice you ever received?
Best pieces of advice is from Jeffrey Gittimer. He basically taught me that if you identify a niche market and then you identify who would need to say yes to you in order to do better and better in your business model. He taught me that if you give away helpful information to that market and you do so once a week, then in 1 or 2 years, you'll be a local expert. And in 2 to 4 years, you'll be a regional expert. And 5 to 7 years, you'll be a global expert on that topic. And when I heard that, I didn't know the family office space existed. I just thought, wow, one day I want to do that for sure. And then when I found out about the family office space, I just chose that as my niche and just applied his formula to the niche. And it changed my whole life and scaled our business. And I was able to go on Gittimer's podcast and tell him that and thank him at one of his live events as well. And so that was probably one of the more impactful, insights or piece of advice someone gave me.
Ah, so great. Well, thanks again for making time for this.
Sure. Yeah. Appreciate you having me on here again. Good to catch up.
Bye, everyone.